Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Listen in as we discuss all things business, growth, and marketing with business owners, thought leaders, and entrepreneurs. And now, here's your host, founder of Roundhouse, the creative agency, Saul Edmonds.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Benny Rubin. Benny, what's up?
That's right. Benny, that's me. You signed that contract I gave you that said that from now on, you're never allowed to have anyone else named Benny on your podcast. You got that agreement, right?
Did you get the memo?
It's one Benny allowed. That's it. No more
one Benny allowed. Yeah. Well, if I get another one, I'll request them to change the name to Ben or two.
Oh, you just have to send Ben. Me. I have to approve them before they,
which I'm sure you will.
Yes, I'll approve them after looking quite seriously at their CV and determining if they're worth the title Benny. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. What about anyone named Jenny?
Jenny's fine.
Oh, okay.
Lenny, Rennie, all those names are fine. Just Benny. I'm just being silly. I've already derailed it. We just got started. I already derailed your podcast.
Off the tracks. That says something very specific about you, Benny. And for people who don't know you, which maybe a few people, why don't you tell them, give them a little bit of a snapshot before we get into the real sort of substance of the podcast? Sure. Give them a little bit of insight into who you are, and also where are you in the world at the moment?
Sure. So you want to do this in reverse chronological? I'm okay with that. My name is Benny Rubin. Currently, I'm CEO and founder of a company called Senders, S-E-N-D-E-R-S. At home on the internet, it's senders.co. Mm. Senders is entirely focused on email sending and delivery. We're not a marketing agency. We're not a lead gen agency. We really concern ourselves with email sendability and deliverability. And we're currently a team of 10 folks. We've been as big as 20 in the past. So we've had a little bit of the old accordion action. And we send millions and millions and millions of emails, almost all of them B2B. So the real question is, how the heck did I end up becoming a B2B email deliverability
expert? You stole my question, Benny. I was going to ask that.
But I think we probably need to take our time to get there.
Yeah. Take a few steps back. Tell everyone listening outside of how you came to be there, what were you, to give a bit of a framework, what were you doing before you came to this point?
Sure.
What's your short history?
Sure. Maybe we could start by defining sendability and deliverability, because I've realized that even amongst tech folks, I live in Brooklyn, New York, by the way, and just last week I was at a networking party amongst all these sophisticated fintech people, and I've never seen so many confused looks when I say, oh, we focus on email deliverability. And I'm like, aren't you all founders? Like, don't you? Well, okay, maybe they don't know. So for those who are listening who've been through an email deliverability crisis, you're nodding vigorously. The toothbrush is in your mouth. Maybe some drool came out because you're like, oh, yes, emails deliverability. Yes,
yeah,
yes, yes.
Finally, someone's talking about it. Yeah.
For those who've never had an issue like that, email itself is an open protocol baked into the fabric of the internet. And that means that it's easy to use and very easy to abuse. And it also means that there are systems that dictate whether an email successfully goes into your inbox or goes to the spam box, but those systems are completely opaque. So companies like mine have email infrastructure experts on them, and we diagnose email delivery problems and we solve them. And then on the other side, we have people who professionally sort of borderline abuse email, salespeople, for example, and they need a lot of intensive help to help their emails not be so annoying for the people they're sending it to, but also potentially get through spam filters. So my team is mainly concerned with diagnosing email sending problems, solving them and also helping sales organizations do their emailing in a way that doesn't do damage to their domain, help they can scale it in the way they need to, and just ultimately, you know, do the quite annoying but also quite necessary part of sales, which is cold email.
Yeah, because it's got a disproportionately sort of large effect, I guess, with people who might not even know what you're talking about, email deliverability in terms of them doing things that they might do in their sales role. I mean, like you were talking about, and then it has some like really large, in their mind, disproportionately large effect on like even the brand too, because the domain, and I'm going to get into this like a little bit more later too, the domain itself, it gets flagged, it gets like blacklisted. It's like all sorts of nasty things happen that people, like a lot of things, when you have no idea of that world, and I guess maybe you can comment on this too. Do people or do some people at least, you know, sort of have an assumption about email that it just sort of happens, and that these things, not knowing that that is, or that it should just happen. And why do I need to have like an email deliverability expert? Like, shouldn't it just happen? Like when I pick up the phone, like, shouldn't you just be able to call? Like, why can't I, what's up with this system? Do you have people?
We do, but it's so interesting because it's sort of like, if you have some sort of weird medical problem and you go to the regular doctor, like let's say you had, you know, your throat is really, your voice is really gravelly and uncomfortable. So you go to a local ear, nose and throat specialist. And then they're like, well, I don't see anything structurally wrong with your throat, but maybe you should talk to a specialist. And you're like, doctor, I thought you were a specialist. They're like, well, no, because there's an actual, like, you know, like there's another layer of specialist.
Yeah, no, that's a good comparison. Yeah.
Two or three layers deep in sort of specialty land. There are people that understand email. Maybe your marketing agency understands email pretty well and knows how to diagnose some issues. Maybe they don't. Maybe the problem isn't super obvious. Maybe the problem is one step deeper. Maybe the problem is a legacy problem that has nothing to do. So what we find is that we tend to not have very many people that are like, why do we need you? By the time they find us, they're like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad we found you.
Sure, really, they've come through that process. Yeah.
And we also do quite a lot of work for the worst word in business, the one that will get you banned from all sorts of places, the F word I'm talking about, free. We also end up doing a lot of work for free because what we found is that a lot of brands come to us with an issue that's fixable in one. It literally would be like the equivalent of like hiring a trainer.
Add the right SPF record or something.
Well, it's like if you hired a trainer. Yeah, it would be like that. But you hire a trainer and you're like, there's something wrong with my bench press and I need your help. And it's like, okay. And then they're like, well, I can tell you right off the bat, you're sitting the wrong way on the bench. That's why you're having trouble with your bench press. It's all like, it's so obvious to anyone who sees it that's an expert. You know what I mean? So people come to us and they say, we're having a crazy problem. Half our emails to go to spam. And sure enough, well, they implemented one framework incorrectly. Everything's out of alignment. Fix that one thing. Problem solved. So we actually do a lot of work for free because if it's really just a one-time fix, it's sort of like, buddy, just like use the bench press machine the correct way. You don't need to hire a trainer. Just like turn around.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what you mean? Oh, that's how the leg extension machine works? I had no idea. And you're like, yeah, now you know. So oftentimes we just end up doing a lot of work for free because it's not really a sustainable long-term problem. It's sort of an easy to diagnose one-time thing. But most of our revenue comes from clients that need us to host emails that we work over a long period of time where they know exactly why they're with us. And I think that there are probably a lot of listeners to this that feel something similar about their own business.
Yeah.
Maybe they're more specialists and they understand how to be there for the clients that just need what they do.
Yeah. I mean, I relate to that very strongly too. There's a lot of things that we end up doing for free when someone says, or just general, you know, advice too, because there's a lot of things, and it just adds general value. Plus, it's also kind of, it's often, you know, it's just stupid to charge for something that's literally going to, you know, that's just helping out a little bit, that literally takes you like a minute or like 5 minutes to do.
I mean, in the past, we've tried it. We've tried to say, okay, this is the problem. There's, you know, these are the things that we're going to have to do. This is the time we think it'll take. How about this price? But what we found oftentimes is that even though we were providing expertise and quality that they needed, the net result was a happy person who felt like they had paid for a service, and we had to sort of balance their expectations, which is fine. We decided that we were really only interested in that in a few categories and not six category. But yeah. I think, you know, part of the beauty of business, and this relates to your business and my business and everyone's business, is it's really one of the only areas of your life where you get a lot of agency and a lot of choice. And you really can say, these are the kinds of clients I like, these are the clients I don't like. I'm going to fire this client. I'm going to keep this client. I'm going to pursue this client. Can't do that with family. Can't do that with health. Can't do that with, if you have a, I'm in the United States, so you can't do that, even do that with doctors. Cause if you were going to do that because you have a health insurance plan with particular doctors that are in network or out of network, there's so many areas of your life where you can't really do that. And business is one of the areas where you can. So I think it's nice to just say, you know what, we're not going to charge for this anymore, but we're going to continue to charge for that, or we're going to be helpful to this group and not that group, and we're okay with that or something. So I think
that's often a organic process. Like, you can probably relate to this too, because I know you've had other ventures too. Like you've had a couple of other businesses, is that right? You sold one, and then there was another one. But like that process that you go through that you don't always realize is even happening, like as you're doing it, where you come to certain realizations at a particular point about like things, what you were saying, like you realize at some certain point, which is just part of the process. It's almost like nothing you can really even plan for, only with maybe you can through more expertise and more experience, like better next time, but it doesn't mean you're not going to have like a different realization where somebody, you know, at some point, like you were saying, just like, after all these years, I finally realized, like me, I'm a fairly good learner, but a slow learner in some areas. Like I'll be like, oh man, I made that mistake a lot of times. But eventually when I do come to the realization, it's pretty solid. Like it's a solid, I'll be like, yeah, now I know. Now I like to do this and I don't like to do this. Might take me a long time, maybe longer than like a lot of other people. I'm cool with that now. You know, I used to be frustrated by it. I'd be like, that's just so stupid. So like, you know, honestly, but at least then eventually you come to the realization. And like you were saying, like I don't think I've ever looked at it quite like that before. So you're saying that was like a little bit of a, like is kind of nice putting the business experience in that perspective, but it is very true. I think that's true. So what were you doing? So before Senders then, was it also email related or completely different?
So what happened was, not to go too far in the past, but I have my degree in music. And in music school, I went to music school in Boston, a school called the Berklee College of Music, where I focused on all sorts of contemporary music, and I play violin and viola and electric bass and some guitar. And I've never became a great player, but I always had a lot of interest in music and passion in music and played a lot. I also got interested in music business. when I was at music school. And I ended up moving to Japan pretty soon after graduating school because I was also really interested in the Japanese language. After I finished studying Japanese and had finished my degree in music, my buddies had all finished music school and were joining bands. So I toured as a bass player for a Sony artist in my early 20s. And I really didn't like it. But Saul, the funny thing is, and there are a lot of reasons why I didn't like it, but we don't have to get into those, but I just didn't really enjoy it, even though the artist was really lovely and it was overall a good experience. That was when social media became a thing. I find this to be very entertaining that you and I are like old timers and we sort of remember the world before social media took over everything. But Twitter had basically just become a thing. Facebook was just a thing. These were new things. And I saw firsthand that the artists that were able to connect with their fans directly were winning. Which now seems so ridiculously obvious that anyone under this a certain age will be like, wait a minute, there was a time when artists wouldn't communicate directly to the fans. And you're like, yes, that was not a thing that artists did.
Yeah. That's why and it doesn't seem like a long time ago, but it kind of, that's the thing. There's something about 2000 forward to now that's still for me, even though I know it's like 20 plus years. Doesn't seem like that because it's in the 2000s, which sounds completely illogical, but that's how I view it. Like I constantly have to be going, hang on, man, yeah, like that's 23 years ago. That's quite a while, but
it's funny because some things changed.
What's changed?
That was a really big change, was all of a sudden artists now connect directly with their fans. And so I started a company in Japan that brought English celebrity social media into Japanese. And this is, we're getting closer to where we are now today, even though it seems very far. I inadvertently started a B2B business. So I had to go to the record labels in Japan and pitch them on my services. And I had to say, hey, Justin Bieber is posting all this stuff in English. You're Japanese fans. There's the language barrier. There's some channel barriers because at the time there were other social networks besides Twitter and Facebook that were popular in Japan. Can you pay us to bring this content into Japanese in this new way? And so I became a B2B salesperson and I've learned that I'm actually more interested in B2B. Up till now has been B2B. So in the middle, we built that business and we sold it to a bigger agency that we'd partner with. Again, another B2B sale. Selling a company is very B2B, right? Like you have the skill set to sell the business. And then at the time that we sold it, there was a new thing that was coming up, which was influencer marketing. And personally, I had almost no interest in influencer marketing, but I was really interested in the fact that social media was being distributed and it wasn't centralized in brands having to make all the content. There's user generated content and all these other elements at play. So, the same friend that I started my first business with, we built a lightweight platform for sort of managing groups of content creators. Not the right guys to build it. Our timing was weird. We shut it down. Not too long after, maybe a year, year and a half after attempting to launch it. And in the ashes of that, I went to all my entrepreneur friends because we had done an accelerator and we'd met all these awesome people. And I just asked, hey, you all know me. You know what I'm good at. What can I help you with? And they're like, you're good at cold email. Maybe you could help with that. So I said, great. So I started a practice that helped businesses set up and scale cold email. Now there's a lot of cold email agencies. There's thousands. At the time there was like five or six. So it's pretty good. Maybe 2015, 2016.
Yeah.
Pretty soon, we started to get very serious about email sending and delivery, and that morphed into where we are today. That changed in 2020 when Google started to clamp down on sending rules and things started to change. We got really serious about the actual mechanics of sending and delivery. I brought on an awesome technician on my team that's still with me today. And he and I went about figuring out exactly how to organize cold email in a way that was in the best long-term interest of sales teams. Mm. And then that developed into where we are today. That's literally the whole story. I mean, it's, you know, whatever. I got married somewhere in there and like other personal stuff, but like, yeah, that's basically my whole professional career.
Is there something, interesting thread that I find in a lot of the different podcasts that you sort of touched on, which is this idea of things arriving out of the ashes of other things, which I constantly really relate to that just in our like own lives and business and stuff too. And whilst no one is ever going to purposefully destroy something so they can like have something amazing grow out of it, because you'd be, you know, sort of a nut if you did, and it probably wouldn't work then anyway, you know, because you'd be destroying stuff all the time, you'd never get anything done. But like you'd be but it is really true, like you mentioning that then out of the ashes, I mean, other people don't say it like that, but the bushfire thing or fire thing, you know, forms the basis for future growth. And then this opportunity that comes where you're talking with all these other people and there's this accelerator and a different, and you ended up going down this path instead of like this path. And yeah, you had these questions answered, which may have happened. Who knows? May not though. And then you're here. But also like the fact that, I guess I'm relating this to myself a little bit too, but other people that I know, like there's skills that you sort of see translate. I mean, I'm making a few assumptions about you being a musician too, because like probably very detailed, sort of orientated, you know, a focus on, you know, patterns and like detail. And there's a lot of those like sort of skills that are in seemingly unrelated areas that then end up being quite strong, same sort of skills that you can easily apply, like you probably have. Like I'm assuming a lot of things here that, no, I don't even know you, Benny, but like I'm not. But, you know, those, I always find it really super interesting when then someone says, well, I've done this, and someone listening might go, oh, wow, that's kind of interesting. That seems really unrelated. But I sort of see it as being very closely related in a patterns and like core skill set sort of way, and maybe your approach to things. What do you think about that?
I think that there's, I think in many ways we're all building businesses that's tried to make up for or overcome very particular and obvious weaknesses, whether they're mental weaknesses or physical weaknesses or whatever. And I see friends that have tried to build businesses that try to leverage their strengths more than cover up weaknesses. And I always find that to be kind of entertaining. I think that this sense of opportunity that you feel about your own business, or people feel about their businesses that are listening to this, that sense is actually a really, really important sense. But that sense is also very, very different from the actual strengths that you have or the weaknesses you're trying to cover up with the businesses you're building. And that sounds very abstract, but I benefit from businesses that have a very, very low variation.
Mm.
That's personally. I find that in my formative years, when I was practicing a lot of music, you try to control for as many variables as you can. You stand in the same place. You hold the violin or viol in the same position. You're trying to build gradual skills over time. You're trying to accrue hours behind the instrument. And right, like you're laying train tracks 1 centimeter at a time.
Mm.
And train will get somewhere. You don't know if it'll get all the way there, wherever there is, but you're doing it a little bit of time. So I've always been attracted to businesses where the sales process is very repetitive and very focused and clear. Mm. The right? Like cold email, you're sending emails every day. You're doing it very consistently. Email deliverability, you're minding very detailed things over a long period of time. Little by little, you're building. I think that it took me, I think I estimate it took me 1,000 hours of sales calls to get my annual recurring revenue over $1 million.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very much like sport or like, or any repetitive sort of activity too. There's that, cause I never got very good at the violin, but I used to play it at school too, you know, when I was at school, and I don't think I ever really valued it probably. But now afterwards, I always think, I was like, oh, I really like the violin. So it's interesting, but I do like strongly relate to that sort of idea. Cause actually now you saying that was like email is, say, unlike some other digital marketing activities where you do something and then it sits there, or you do something and then there's some interaction with it. Like email, whilst that's true, I guess to some extent with email in its different forms, it is a bit more like a real time sport, repetitive sort of activity. I've never really
email in a certain sense it is, but it's also most people, and maybe you're like this and I don't know, most people thrive on novelty and they thrive on new, interesting, exciting things. We have a creative agency and it's always something new, always something exciting and interesting and different. And we have a lot of clients that do different things and that's really nice. But I always try to optimize for very precise motions with as few variables as possible.
Mm.
That's why we don't do very many services.
Less things to go wrong.
Less things to go wrong is one way to put it, but also just, you know, I don't know. I think that just
simple is good though. Yeah, no, but there's like certainly real strength in that too. And I think to some extent, to some people at least who might come to you or looking in at a service provider from the outside, there's some sort of level of someone who's going, we do these and we do them well. That's that can be quite a powerful sort of message, like even before they interact, with you.
Yeah, I think I agree on multiple levels with that. I also think that it's the basis for a scene. I think you and I are old enough to remember that there used to be something called music scenes.
Mm.
It was important that all the bands in the music scene were very similar or somewhat similar because you needed to have a certain number of fans, but every band needed to be unique enough that they couldn't be replaced by one another. Mm. And that's what made the show fun to go to.
Mm. Yeah. It creates that sort of group dynamic, creates a certain sort of culture then over time that, sort of allows for the right amount of growth. Like I guess in any, you know, if you want to say ecosystem, there's the right amount of, there's a natural sort of ebb and flow of things that allow other things to happen or not happen. And it finds its own kind of level, like water does. It'll just like end up going, okay, this is right at this point. And that just kind of has to, you know, happen of its own accord.
So it means that fundamentally that other agencies that also are very specific in what they do can recommend business to you and you to them. Mm. So the more things that you add to your menu, the fewer opportunities you have to recommend other people, even though you think that you have more opportunities to be recommended. Actually, the more specific and more precise you are, the more likely people are to recommend you. So when we made the choice to stop talking ourselves as like talking about ourselves as some sort of lead gen style agency or copywriting stuff or B2B sales growth, blah, blah, blah. When we said like, look, we really only care that really care about email deliverability and sending. That's like where we're really focused.
Mm.
referrals went up a lot. Interest from other people went up a lot. Partnership agencies went up a lot. Visibility went up a lot. And because then you can be part of the scene where you can be, you know, VPs of sales want to know one really awesome copywriting team, one really great automation firm, one great data company that's great at like enriching data really well. And well, we probably should know a deliverability person because we're going to be doing a lot of emails. And if that becomes a problem, that'll be bad. So we'll hire an agency to help us. Most of the people that we know, we're the only ones. Maybe there's another one floating around, but
yeah,
I don't even know about them. So part of it has to do with, it's very pragmatic. It's not just me personally thinking like, oh, I want to do one thing really, really well, but thinking you could frame it more strategically. Like you do need to be in a blue ocean. However, you want to be the, like the blobs of blue that are floating around in the red ocean, basically. You want to be with all the red, but then it's like, well, what's this blue bit floating around?
Yeah. Yeah. The eyes are drawn to the blue bit. Yeah. It's funny because I've always, I've done a, my own sort of logical workaround with how we sort of offer things too. Cause I've always, I don't think I've struggled with that because I've come to the conclusion that we specifically with like all the different types of creative things that we do, it's always centered around brand. That's the focus. So, but that I still like to talk because I think we're good at them and they often feed each other. There's still a lot of different things, but I've come to the conclusion, maybe that same sort of conclusion in my mind anyway. You know, I'm not sure about other people's minds, but like that it's still always very much centered around like the brand and branding, whatever that is. But I mean, yeah, I mean that there's a lot of power in, I guess that flows into being specific too, really, doesn't it? About specifically asking for things or being specific to people about, you know, what, or asking them what they require or what you need from them. Like being specific seems to be sort of at the heart, which gets into like the detail of things. And that's like certainly the case. There's a lot of, you know, technical aspects about what you do in, delivering emails, but could you, I guess, like explain to people listening who at this point go, okay, Benny, now I understand what email deliverability is. What does this apply to in? So I'm Joe Blogs on the street who goes, yeah, cool. I understand that. Now, is he talking about email marketing? Is he talking about transactional emails on like websites? Is he talking about like my Microsoft 365? Like I'm still a little bit mixed up. Could you just give people a little bit more clarity around that? Or is it all of them? All three?
You know, I kind of feel that a lot of people listening to this who don't care that much about email in general aren't
which
kind
is
of
they care about it when it's not working.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
I think that what you should know is
generally
that
they don't care. That's absolutely right because they're doing it all the time.
Like emails aren't performing in the way that you expect them to, or they're not doing the thing they should. You might have a problem, and if your business really relies on email as a channel, you'll feel that problem. It'll be like if you have a sore back and you're waking up every 30 minutes in the middle of the night, your back's just screaming out. That's how people are when they have an email deliverability problem. They go, up until last month, things were okay. Now we don't know what's going on. This is terrible. We're getting reports left, right, and center that things aren't getting delivered right. And you just has like a problem. It's like problem.
Has to go up the chain then though too. So I would say there, I 100% agree. However, the one thing I would say where that doesn't happen, and I've sort of seen this happen a lot, depending on the size or culture of an organization, is when the person who's kind of responsible for, who's like right on the front line, who's seeing the problems, and sometimes they either do communicate it to the person who should or who can do something about it to initiate the change, or they're not very good listeners, or they actually don't communicate it. So, like, what types of organizations, if any, benefit more from your services, or is there such a thing, like, as someone?
I said this before, but there's two different categories. There's sendability and there's deliverability. You know you have a sendability problem if your salespeople are trying to send emails and you're getting notices from Google or Microsoft saying, hey, we're not going to send these emails anymore. Or if you feel very constrained, yeah, we're only going to send 50 emails a day because then the Google gods and the deliverability gods will strike us down. If that's your mindset, then you should probably talk to someone like my team. Why? Mm. All we do is help relieve you of artificial constraints on your email. If you have a deliverability problem, you work in the marketing team and you have email subscribers of 2,000, 5,000, 10,000, 100,000, and you used to get 27.5% open rates, 32% open rates, and now it's 6%, you have a deliverability problem. You don't have any problem sending emails. You have a deliverability problem. Mm. If you have a deliverability problem, you probably need to get help fast. And simply showing a dramatic decrease in open rates with no obvious cause should be enough to ring the alarm bells. Mm. The good news is there really aren't that many different ways and things get messed up, and there aren't that many ways that things can get fixed. Most people listening to this now, I don't know when you're going to publish this, but in February 1st, just a few days ago, Google changed the rules around email sending and delivery. So you might be having a problem that's because of the rules that they changed.
Mm.
The root of these things are what's called DNS, which is the little bits of code that sit on your back of your website that relate to email and other things. If those are out of alignment, and Google just changed the alignment for a lot of people, those are out of alignment, you're going to see a drop in deliverability. Mm. And if you're doing any sort of abuse of email in any other parts of your company, it might come back to haunt your marketing emails too. So I would say that be persistent inside your organization. You can reach out to my team if you want to chat about it, but be persistent inside your own org in terms of bringing attention to the problem. Mm. And build a case. One Slack message, hey, I think there's something wrong with your email deliverability, probably won't cut it. It's probably going to take you copying and pasting some data, maybe taking some screenshots, you know, and sort of looking at different websites and sort of understanding that there's a world out there where your sending goes back to normal and you need to sort of get everyone on the same page with trying to pursue that. But I think you probably there is a path out of it, and you might need help from professionals, or you might be able to solve it on your own, and you should earnestly pursue that.
Yeah, I think there's – I always feel doing a lot of websites and working with DNS and hosting like all the time, every single day, one of the things that I've observed generally about – and this is about people's knowledge, which I guess is an underlying like foundation for then why things get overlooked or things like that. Most people don't know, they know what website hosting generally is. Most people that don't know about DNS at all or even of its sort of existence, let alone its role or all of that sort of stuff. So, I mean, I would probably say, and you can speak to this too, I'm going to get your thoughts on this, as to like, I feel like having a better understanding of that and probably more importantly, who's responsible for it? Is it your IT person? Is it like your mate? Is it like your next door neighbor who originally set up your website hosting like 5 years ago who's now moved to Japan studying violin? Is it that person like who doesn't do web surf anymore and they're gone? I mean, that happens all the time. And then I mean, that's the thing that let alone where people registered their domain. I mean, it's kind of, once again, kind of like email. It's this thing that is really important, like really important to the foundation of one, sending things, communication, like outside of all the technical stuff, you know, your website and foundational things that underpin all of that, like who manages your domain, like who is the person, who's the admin, who manages the DNS, is the DNS somewhere else to the web hosting? Because there's all like every different configuration of how things could be routed or simple or not simple. You know, I've seen them. You've probably seen too. And it's really confusing for even for people often like you and I who know about this stuff. It's like, how have you done it? And like, why did you do it like that? And then it causes, and then down the chain, then there's problems in relation to email because of, you know, any number of things. So the end, like case point, I guess I'm sort of trying to make for people listening is knowing those things, whilst it seems like a really annoying techie thing that they have to know or that they should know, at least know like who's managing it and where it is in the event that one, they come to someone like you and they go, these problems, I have no idea about anything. And it just makes it quicker. The two, they should just know it. Like, you know, what's your bank account number? Like everyone knows that.
Oftentimes those things don't matter until they change. So in other words, if you were on one website building platform on Squarespace and then you hire a new firm and they're like, hey, we're going to build you a Webflow website. You're like, cool, but something's going to have to change in your DNS.
Yeah.
Then if you were using Google for your mail provider and you switched to Microsoft 365, great. That has to be reflected in your DNS. If you roll out Zendesk when before you didn't have a ticketing software, well, that has to be reflected in your DNS. And you're like, okay. So oftentimes the trigger for this is someone from Zendesk or from the company that's helping you set up Webflow or whatever saying, hey, you know, we need to do this. You go, oh gosh, well, golly, I don't know. How does that happen? But a lot of it is queryable. Like you can look at the DNS records and there, if you just type DNS lookup or something and into usually find out things about your own DNS, which you didn't know. But ultimately, yes, you need to find out who your email service provider is, who has admin access to your email, who has admin access to the place you bought your domain, which is usually where you're hosting where your DNS is existing, whether it's GoDaddy or Namecheap or whatever. You know, figure these things out. And then it makes sense if you're new to an org to have a look to make sure that your DNS records are properly aligned, especially if you're seeing a problem with your email.
Yeah.
Email DNS is the first port of call. The second one is the email content. Usually, are you doing something stupid with the actual email text?
Yeah. Is there common, what are the, some of the other, I guess, common myths that, people in general have about, email or email use that you've, stumbled across? Things that just aren't true.
I think that people feel that there are some sort of magical limits on email in different ways, but there actually is no limit on email. So your average person might say, oh, you know, if we have 100,000 email subscribers, that's going to cost us a lot of money because MailChimp charges a lot of money for 100,000 subscribers. On a technical level, there is actually almost no cost difference between sending 1,000 emails and sending 100,000 emails, maybe a few pennies here and there. So you're, all these constraints that are getting put on you from your email service provider side can be changed by simply changing providers to a less expensive one. So that's one side. The other side of this is there aren't, if you're trying to send cold emails, like business solicitation emails, the person, you should know who's restricting you. If you're trying to send from Google or Microsoft, they're the ones restricting you because there's, again, there's no technical limitation on the number of emails that anyone can send. Case in point, what country are you currently in?
Australia.
Australia. So I'm sure the Australian Post sends out emails. They might send out 6 to 15 million emails a day from one email address. So clearly there's no limit. And clearly they're not paying MailChimp $72,000 a month for email services. They're doing it in an open source way or sort of a way that's not costing the Australian taxpayers a tremendous amount of money. One can assume. You can tell me.
That's a very nice idea. Yes. I'm sure that's completely true.
Well, at least country doesn't spend money in the way that the United States of America does on employed in distant lands instead of on schools and things. But anyway, politics aside, there aren't really any limits on email. Oftentimes the companies that are in the middle are the ones placing limits on you. And it's important to understand who is constraining you in what way. And email, because it's an open platform, it's very malleable and things can be moved around really easily. And it's important to find a configuration that actually fits your business and fits what your goals are with email. So be very aware of how you're constrained by the tools that you're currently using and how to break free of those constraints if that's something that you need to do.
Yeah, one of the rules of the game, I guess. Hey?
Yeah, it's helping sales team break out of the constraints that they're feeling. It's a pretty important thing for a sales team. If they're sending 200 emails a day, a very modest number of emails, and they know they could do better if they're sending 400, but they're hitting some sort of limit, or if it's 400 and they're trying to get to 4,000, it sounds like a lot of emails, but if you have a very large total addressable market, it's not that crazy. What is holding you back? Spends a tremendous amount of our time helping companies overcome arbitrary blocks that they thought were impenetrable, but they're actually not.
I think that's a really key point too, is often things that seem quite insurmountable are often some very simple solution, like we talked about right at the start of the podcast too. Like sometimes things are stupidly simple and they just, you know, people don't know what they don't know, of course. You know, it's like me, it's like any of us knowing, you know, how to fix some plumbing related problem that we go, yeah, you can like work it out. Like I actually did something like that literally last night. Our roller door on the shed, something happened, which I won't go into, but something happened, but the whole thing that just went loose and it came out like a big sheet of lasagna and it just like was all floppy. Like, oh crap. It's like had no idea how to fix it up, but through just, you know, sort of observation, took like about 4 hours to do it. But like these things that at first glance I was like, oh no, you've got to be kidding, I have no idea. Frustration set in, then logic, and then, you know, it's sort of these sort of underlying potentially simple things to put in place. Like, for example, things we've been talking about that people could, like, you know, not knowing, like we were saying before, who manages the DNS, who set up the domain, things like that. There's, you know, talk all the time from IT people about having your backups, very sensible. Yes, doing this. You got someone managing that important part of your business. Everything would crash if it went down. Things would also crash in many instances if someone's website goes down, depending on the website, or at least have terrible, you know, brand repercussions at varying levels, easy to mitigate, like stupidly easy to mitigate. Take a little bit of time initially to find out who does what, make a record of it. You know, things that relate to what you do to speed up the process, you know, who manages the DNS. They're the things that I would have to say probably one out of every two people, probably about 50%, if not more, when we do a website or anything that relates to DNS or hosting, probably like easily more than 50% don't know that information and like have to, you know, search like the archives of their mind or look through some old, like, you know, scrolls written on paper, you know, to sort of find the information. They have to get like the parchment out and like unroll it and like translate the hieroglyphs and like, you know, look through the Sumerian texts and, you know, and then they finally come to the conclusion after consulting.
Like they're calling their old uncle and being like, do you remember where we bought this domain? But you can find most of that stuff just by looking around. But then, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, I always then say to people, I usually just like skip over it because they're, I mean, the same sort of tools, just go on to, you know, who is MX Toolbox, whatever.
Yeah.
Find the information out and they're like, wow, how did you do that? It's like,
magic.
I threw a bat's wing, a piece of saliva and something into a pot and added this special liquid. And then I poured that into the computer. No, it's skinny.
You're talking about rapid COVID test?
Rats.
Remember we had to do rapid COVID tests all the time, even though everyone knew that those tests were funky. We were all like, all right, I'll do another rapid COVID test.
That's just a terrible example of branding there. So rat tests. In Australia, I'm not sure what they were called there, but it was rapid something. Yeah, something, but the shortened version was rat. I was like, a rat test? Really? You're calling it a rat test? Guys, where's your marketing team? Yeah. So you got, but so tell me about Senders Protocol. I was having a look on your website. Sure.
Senders Protocol is just the term that we use for all of the things that go into helping someone succeed with their cold emailing.
Mm.
Because what we found is that people kept asking, oh, are you a piece of software? And we'd say, well, there's lots of software involved. Are you a consultancy? Well, yes, we consult, but we're not a consultancy. Oh, so you solve the problem in our place, not in yours. Oh, no, we host part. It got a little bit funky and confusing. So we bucket it all and we just called Senders Protocol because it's a series of heuristics, best practices that we implement, things that we host, stuff that we're doing on our end that has nothing to do with what the client sees or does, like in terms of IP address management and things like that. So we just bucket it all under Senders Protocol, which I think is an okay name. I'm not sure if I'm 100% sold on it, but we've been saying it for years now. So
yeah, no, I mean, when I can only say from my response, when I go to a new website and went to yours and I was reading through it, that made sense to me. So, I mean, if that's any help.
Yeah, that is. Like, I appreciate that.
Yeah, because I'm have a bit more expertise in certain areas, but I'm still just like anyone. As you respond, you either kind of respond well to things, you take it in more readily, or you don't. And that was that makes sense because I'm also had lots of questions because whilst I know about what you do and why you do it and generally sort of how you do it, I still just have this sort of lens as a designer of looking at things. I just can't help it. My mind will just go straight to, oh, does that kind of communicates that well? I'll just like be analyzing it without even realizing I'm doing it. Yeah. Like I'll be like, oh, Senders, That makes sense to me. That's good.
It's like interesting. I mean, it's interesting to have a design language. I don't think so much about design in that sense, but I'm very sensitive to when people show me the cold emails that they're going to be sending for business development.
Mm.
Because we write so many cold emails and we think a lot about cold email and we receive a lot of cold emails and we've set up cold email or had a part of it for hundreds of companies, 250, 300 companies, maybe more in the last 6-7 years. I just have a visceral reaction like, oh yeah, I don't think this will play well. I don't think this will work well. And even though we don't really do a lead gen agency so much and we're not really in that business, we freely dispense advice and we freely try to share information from clients that are succeeding to clients that are potential clients. I mean, for example, today I had a call with a person who was really happy with their results with cold emailing and they're very, very happy. And you dig one step further and say, okay, well, what's that? Well, it's leading to 10 sales calls per week. Well, that's amazing. I'm running the numbers and I said, you know, I don't know if you're succeeding with your sales calls because you should have built a much bigger business by now with that level of sales meetings. Of course, that leads to them telling us, well, only 20% of them are qualified.
Right.
And then I said, wow, that's okay. That's fine. You can build a sales process where you talk to 10 people and 2 are qualified, but that's a problem with what you're saying in the email. And he's like, why do you think aren't I very successful? And I brought up the simple point. This seems like a very self-congratulating tale, but it's not.
Go ahead.
You're not giving people the chance to self-disqualify. Your tent is too wide. It's too big. You're bringing all these people in that maybe you don't need to talk to. And one of the things that I always think about when I read people's emails or I look at their websites is just how differentiated are they versus how differentiated do they think they are? And are they qualifying the people who read the site and disqualifying the people who don't read the site? And the reason why I say that is oftentimes I read websites that are supposed to be aimed at me and I feel no resonance. I'm just like, is this for me? I can't even tell. Next. And occasionally you find
that answers you,
or you find something that like you're just like, oh yeah, this is what I need. Like this is the thing, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of ambiguity there, really, isn't it? It's very much about the sort of the feeling that the end user receives, and then for the person sending to kind of improve that, and then to quantify, like. You touched on the, you know, that sort of related point just before, is that I feel like most people, with the exception of probably people who've been doing it long enough and have sort of reflected on it enough and analyzed it enough, but everybody else will go, okay, this is my marketing. This is, I know that because some person told me I should do email marketing and some person told me and that I should be doing social media because it's, you know, because everyone's doing it. And so I heard a success story about somebody doing it and they just got to do it. And then they don't think generally, and this, it's not really a, I don't feel it's like it's a negative comment to say this. It's just an observation of sort of truth, is that people have their focus, justifiably so, on certain things. Most of the time, it's just the inner workings of their business. It's their day-to-day troubles. It's their, you know, their focuses, which usually aren't on their marketing because there's either somebody else, unless unless like, you know, all of us, when you're originally starting out, you do everything and then you go, wow, that's just way too hard. Plus I'm getting really tired and I can't do it anymore. And then you earn more money and you can get somebody else to help you and then they do it. And you're very thankful to hand it over to them so you don't have to think about it anymore. And that, I think, is an underlying, not sort of saying, hey, everyone who's become successful, go back and do all those things again, because that would be stupid. But maybe like just still having some insight into it, which I reckon is just then better communication in teams to going, what are you doing? Them telling you if, you know, it's probably a 5 minute conversation sometimes just to find these things out. Because at the end of the day, all the hard work of these other things can become completely useless. Then if some fundamental stuff like many of the things we've been talking about just aren't addressed, and there's like the, you know, it's like, you know, you're paying somebody X amount to be your in-house marketing person and they're doing all this stuff and they don't want to because they're awkward. It's very awkward for them to go to the boss and go, we're having these problems, because they're like, I don't want to hear about that. I don't like techie stuff. And
Well, I think there's a couple things. I think that one thing that we hear a lot about people rolling out channels for marketing, but we actually don't hear very much about people stopping channels for marketing. It's a little bit less common to say, we put a tremendous amount of effort into our blog for the last 3 years, and we've decided that we will no longer be putting attention on our blog. And it's totally possible that's the right move to make. Or, you know, we put a lot of effort into our Facebook page, but now we don't care about Facebook anymore. So we're going to, you know, change it or shut it down or something. So I think that there's something really interesting about not only keeping tabs on what is being worked on, but also what is static and then what it should be sort of deprecated. And I think it's a pretty exciting proposition for anyone just to say, that's something that we used to care about, but we don't care about that anymore. And then the boss just being like, okay, you don't care about that anymore. That's fine. We don't care about that anymore.
It can be very freeing, especially for somebody who's like the person that we work with a lot, person X, like who's the in-house marketing person that traditionally for us being a creative agency would do like a bunch of stuff. Lots of people who are in that role don't always, they're fired because of stuff I was saying before, because like the boss used to do it or other people, and they're like, finally, we can get somebody to do it. And they have this expectation of that person. And sometimes they, you know, can do everything. They can do graphic design and they do this, that, but more often than not, they can't. And then they've got to come to an agency, and those people are like on the ground actually doing the stuff. But I found in many instances, the communication, you know, not that there's often any problem, but it's just not because there's a problem, but because there's people don't see a need to share stuff. You know, it's not even like, oh, I can't communicate with my boss. It's just they don't, they're just doing their job and they don't really think about it because they're not us, and they're not the business owner, so they don't have any skin in the game to go, oh, I really want to like improve this. They're just doing their job, and that's cool, you know. But still, outside of that, there's these underlying things that occur over time, like for like the sort of effect that it actually has on a business. But just a quick question about how like, how do you find many marketing agencies, say, specifically work with you? Like, say they're doing some email marketing campaigns already, and they're, like, responsible for design and then the copy. Where do you fit in some scenarios
into that? Well, there's three kinds of agencies that we tend to work with when we do work with agencies or partner with agencies. There are full service style marketing agencies that might be doing email marketing. The client asks them, hey, we want to do this B2B email thing. And they go, ooh, we don't really do B2B email. So they bring us in as a side partner to help with just the B2B part, because they can't do that in Klaviyo or MailChimp or whatever system they're doing. And so they need a specialist team to help get that set up. So that's one way. The second way and this is more rare, but the second way is email, cold email agencies. Sometimes they say this client wants to scale beyond what we like to do in house. So we're going to partner with you. We don't white label. We need direct access to the client. That's just part of the way that we do business. So we're brought in to backstop the sending part, and the cold email agency is doing the front end part, the email drafting, the sequencing, maybe data enrichment or whatever. And then the third one is marketing consultants. There are a lot of consultants, fractional CMOs, folks like that, that have a hodgepodge of different kinds of agencies that they partner with. Maybe agencies like yours, agencies like mine, variety of freelancers. So we're part of the mix of how they bring us in. And it's usually very purpose specific. So we say, this is Tina. She's going to be running the campaigns. She's a freelancer. She's part of my team. This is senders. They're going to be doing all the email backend deliverability stuff. Everybody work together. And then we jump in for that purpose. So I'd say there's three different patterns.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that question is, more specifically for, you know, someone like myself, and I know, you know, a whole host of like other people in sort of agencies who will probably be listening to that, who would have had that question. They were like, well, how could I? Because like, I like doing it like this, and I've had this experience in the past, and like, I've never worked with an email delivery waddy person before. They haven't.
If you do have a client, if people listening have a client that the email deliverability is in question, just reach out. Like I said, if it's a one-time fix thing, we're happy just to help fix it. It's no big deal to us. And if you do have a client that is doing B2B stuff, like they're trying to cold email and it's not working how they expect, or it's getting lumped into other marketing things, we're absolute experts at helping separate that out and then make that successful and stand on its own, letting your team do the more opt-in emailing side, which most marketing agencies excel at opt-in email and are not so keen on the cold email. Only certain kinds of agencies care a lot or know a lot about the cold side, which is what we're really good at.
Yeah, I guess it's just sort of knowing, or from their part, at least like knowing where they're going to fit in, or where you're going to fit in rather, like into their sort of, setup.
Well, first things first, we give advice for free, and anyone can reach out to ask for advice, and we'll give advice to the agency. We don't need to talk directly to the client. And usually in those advice oriented sessions, if there is something that does involve it, needs to involve the client directly, then we chat it through.
Yeah, sure. I guess one final thing before because we're getting sort of at the tail end of the podcast, I guess, but I found it really interesting. Not that I've looked at heaps and heaps of email deliverability businesses online in recent times, because I haven't, but I found it really interesting and kind of nice and I mean that in like, you know, a sincere sort of way that you're talking about the technical side of things and senders protocol and all this sort of stuff. And then you've got this big part on your website about like strategy. And whilst I know to a lot of people, that's a very, common thing. If you're going to an agency, people are going to have a strategy and this and that, but it's not something that I've sort of seen a lot in your realm. There's a lot of talk about, you know, just the structure, the plan and the technical side, but I kind of thought that was really good. Like I know it's probably like something that is just very normal for you, but I thought that was really great, like from my perspective, because it, like my first reaction to that when I saw that was that sort of instilled a different feeling in me, like from as an agency, about the kind of thinking that you have. It told me before I read other stuff, it was like, oh, that's interesting. Like that feels a bit, it's sort of hard to exactly put into words, but it's still a different sort of confidence, I suppose, in me. Like to.
Well, I think on a fundamental level, if you're doing emailing and you're not sure why, there's a bigger problem than are your emails being delivered.
You have a plan.
You know? And the other side of this is, like we talked about a little bit earlier with that person who said, hey, I generate 10 interested replies per week, and that's great. And we said, well, how many of them are valuable? Only two. You could argue it's tactical. I mean, people mix up strategy and tactics all the time. So we'll just give us a pass on this. But on a tactical or strategic level, depending on how you want to slice it, you can change strategies and keep the method the same. An example in the marketing world would be, if you have a really great email newsletter, it's very active, but you're not getting any conversions, then you ask the question, well, what are you trying to convert people to? Mm-hmm. And then they say, well, we want them to click and go to the website. And you say, okay, what do you expect them to do on the website? You know, like so pretty soon you are in a strategy conversation where you're saying, well, look, I looked at your website. The only thing that you can do on the website is register for a demo call or join a webinar. Why don't you market the webinar over email and see if that works to drive, right? It's like, that is this rocket science? Are we changing the world? Are we? No, but strategically someone can shift their focus and get a lot more out of it. So we spend a lot of time on strategy, even when we're not charging for strategy, because people come to say, hey, we have a sending problem, we have a delivery problem. We say, great, what are you trying to do with email? Okay, first let's adjust that, and then we can get into the real sending and scaling.
Yeah. Well, it's hard for anyone who's doing a job for somebody else, you know, to do their job or to find the right answers or solutions unless they know why they're meant to be doing this or that. I mean, it's like I said, it's not rocket science, but it is still surprisingly, like I would argue probably almost the norm that people just go, I just want them to, you know, to click on it but they don't know why. And that, I mean, so we've covered like a bunch of stuff here, Benny.
We covered a lot of stuff.
Yeah, we covered a lot of stuff.
Talk about was your favorite Australian bands or something. Let's see. Who's Australian? AC/DC?
Yeah, they're getting on now. They're like a iconic. Actually, I was
AC/DC is awesome.
Yeah, that's
a great band.
They've been around forever. They're still going, I think. I don't know anything about what they've been doing recently, but I think they're still around. I think they're still like going strong with all down.
Okay. I just found an article on Ranker, which is not a website I was familiar with. 100, the best Australian bands ranked. And Men at Work, that's a classic Australian band. Silverchair, that's a pretty solid Australian band. There's a bunch of these bands I've never heard of or never listened to. Nick Cave, obviously. Do you like Nick Cave?
Yeah,
he's good. Nick Cave is awesome.
Yeah, okay. A bunch
Tame
of
old. Impala, that's a big one. You guys have, that's a big hit.
Yeah.
Tame Impala.
Okay, yeah.
I'm going to dig into some Australian music after this.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of, I haven't actually been having a big focus on particular bands in recent times because of like other sorts of things I've been into, like sport and stuff, because I play squash. So I'm a sports guy.
Yeah, I'm a music guy.
Yeah.
Sports has never captured my interest as much as music.
Yeah. I sort of like both, but in recent times there's been, actually you just had it in, it's a big thing for squash nerds. JP Morgan one in New York.
Oh yeah. That's the one they do in the hotel ballroom with the glass box and everyone sits there all hoitily and watching them sipping wine and stuff while they jump around the glass box. That is the optics wise for a total outsider like me.
Yeah.
That is the funniest possible scenario to enjoy a sport.
It's funny because like from the squash perspective, they started doing that a number of years ago now because squash is very, it being inside a box, like it unlike other sports, it gives limited physical sort of access to people watching it. So they came up with this thing and they do it all around the world. Yeah, in a really great sort of way with 360, they actually have one in Egypt, which is near the pyramids that they do sort of outside. And you've got the pyramids in the background. But squash often I won't spend too much time on squash because we're finishing up our podcast about email deliverability. But like the, they've worked very hard on making it more accessible, put it that way.
I think it's cool. I mean, I just think it's really funny. The optics of it are really funny. It is as close to a fishbowl as humans have ever engaged with. It's like going to the aquarium for squash. I mean, that's cool.
I know. I mean, I've never actually seen the full 360 core before in the flesh. I've seen like three-sided ones, but I'd actually really like to get over to New York 1 year for that, because that's actually one of the biggest tournaments in the world, the JP Morgan one. That's actually like a big sort of event. But before we wrap up, Benny, have you got any like final sort of words or thoughts that are really important that you'd like to share with people, like some sort of key point or something that we didn't touch on?
There's a quote that my friend told me the other day, and I'm sure that there's a million derivative quotes and other people have said things in different ways. But he told me, why take a big step when you could take a small step instead? And it really stuck with me, and I think about it a lot since he told that to me.
Mm.
And the way I interpret that, and everyone needs to interpret things their own way, but the way I interpret it is, I think we oftentimes feel like we're presented with big decisions, but we're actually presented with very small incremental decisions.
Yeah. So
an example would be if someone feels discontent with their business they're in, they say, maybe I should sell my business. Maybe it's time to sell my business, something like that. And you're like, that's a really big step. That's very different from like, maybe I should take Friday off and not think about work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like I constantly think, okay, that feels like the big thing, but what's the small thing? What's the small thing that is like right in front of me that maybe
or the help? Series. So I often
think about that. Yeah.
I think
it was my buddy Drew who told me that. And Drew is an excellent musician. He's a musical director for all these famous artists. And I didn't actually get a chance to ask him how he interprets it. But he's the one who said it to me. Drew Tobenfeld is his name.
Yeah.
He also makes fantastic music you can find online.
That's cool. Yeah, no, I relate to that very strongly. It's something we've been talking about a lot recently at home, my wife and I, actually for quite a while now, that we feel like at the heart of getting anything done, even those big things that you might take the big step, is ultimately like just the easy way to get there is like a series of little steps. It's just like bit by bit by bit by bit, but consistently. It's the consistent small steps. One, because then all of a sudden you wake up one day and you've taken a big step and you didn't even realize you were doing it. And I think that's a really great sort of.
I think also, I mean, you and I both know, because we're business owners, that most of the value in the world is built small step at a time. Very rarely does someone say, I'm going all in on this.
Mm.
You know, I think that it's sort of a popular idea that people take one big bet and that's the big thing and I just never found that that's actually how life is.
Mm.
And even if you think about life as a poker table, it's very different for someone going all in on a $1,000 hand in poker.
Mm.
That's very different. If they saved that $1,000 for 20 years and they're going all in on one hand, that's probably stupid. Mm. That $1,000 is actually only a small amount of their total net worth or accessible capital anyway.
Yeah. So
anyway, I think why take a small step? Why take a big step when you can take a small step? Seems to be a nice framework to think through when you're frustrated or thinking through how to build your business.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. And thanks so much for being on the podcast. Also, Benny, I really appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. Folks, reach out if you heard this and anything I said resonated anyway, even just to tell me that I'm wrong about squash and people aren't you know, it's the optimal way to engage with them.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. And with that in mind, with many being right, thank you everyone for listening again to the Grow Business Podcast. And we'll see you again soon. And say goodbye, Benny. Say goodbye to everyone.
Bye. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone. See ya.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Grow Your Business. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time here at the Grow Your Business Podcast.